Hello, I'm David Hatfield, and this is Classical Music Connection. Major support for Classical Music Connection is provided by Matinee Musicale Cincinnati. Now, let's find out what's on today's program. In the March 2022 edition of the BBC Music Magazine, Simon Broughton introduces us to the Lausitz Festival in Germany. Lausitz isn't a town, but a region in Germany. It's not well known, even in Germany, but the Lausitz Festival, which takes place in August and September each year, gives a rare opportunity to see top artists, such as pianist Marta Argerich, violinist Gidon Kremer, and composer and saxophonist John Zorn in some extraordinary venues, including the Jugendstil State Theater in Cottbus, a fantasy castle in Bad Muskau, and Görlitz Synagogue, one of few in Germany that survived Kristallnacht. One festival performance took place in a former Stasi prison in Bautzen. Visitors get to see some very interesting places, seeing cultures change virtually within the length of a cigarette, and get to reflect on that with performances that are unique, says Israeli-born festival director Danielle Kühnel, who has also been director of the Hamburg Symphony Orchestra for the last 16 years. It is really an experience. Lausitz is in the far east of Germany, in the states of Saxony and Brandenburg, and extends over the Neisse River into Poland and south into the Czech Republic. First held in 2020, the festival has funding in place until 2038. It includes music, theater, film, and spoken word. But for non-German speakers, its music is the main draw. Lausitz Festival headquarters is in Görlitz, a handsome town which survived the war virtually intact, with a jewel-like old town at its heart. Kühnel points out that it's halfway between Moscow and Santiago de Compostela, so truly at the center of Europe. It has been dubbed Görliwood, as it is frequently used as a filming location, featuring in Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds, Stephen Daldry's The Reader, and Wes Anderson's The Grand Budapest Hotel, among others. All the street signs in the cobbled center of town can be swiftly unscrewed for filming purposes. The Neisse River runs through Görlitz, which since 1945 has formed the Polish border. And festival events also take place in Zgorzelec on the Polish side. One concert with pianist Piotr Andrzejewski playing Bach Preludes and Fugues had its first half in the Görlitz Synagogue in Germany, and with a walk over the Neisse, the second half in St. Bonifatius Church in Zgorzelec, Poland. Also on the Polish side is the site of the World War II prisoner of war camp, where Messiaen composed and performed his quartet for the end of time. The festival always features Messiaen's music, and, reflecting its geography, Polish and Czech composers have some prominence in the program. The festival, funded mostly by Germany's central government, is to help reinvigorate an area of former East Germany where the mining and textile industries have disappeared and votes for the right-wing NPD party are strong. It's to make people from outside aware that it's nice to be here and give them another reason to come, says Kunel. And to tell people here that great things happen here, too. But you can't just copy the Salzburg Festival and put it here, because Salzburg is a beautiful small town, but this is a region that takes 2.5 hours to drive across. An hour's drive from Görlitz is Bad Muschkau, a large estate, now a UNESCO World Heritage Site, created by the larger-than-life count and garden designer Hermann von Pückler-Muschkau, 1785 to 1871. He built a neo-Baroque castle in the early 19th century, surrounded by a carefully landscaped but natural-looking English garden, which now extends 6 square kilometers over the German-Polish border. Pückler was much influenced by English garden designer Humphrey Repton, whom he met in 1816. Bad Muschkau Castle was in ruins after World War II, but restored after German reunification in the 1990s. From the castle, which has a nice exhibition about Count Pückler, you can walk through the gardens across bridges into Poland and back. The castle has also been the host for a festival performance of Oswaldo Golijov's Dreams and Prayers of Isaac the Blind, a powerful piece for clarinet quintet, depicting a few thousand years of Jewish history through musical invocations of its Aramaic, Yiddish, and Hebrew stages. Jewish music is a major ingredient in the festival, particularly in 2021, which marked 1,700 years of Judaism in Germany. The cordon going from here through Silesia to Galicia and the Black Sea was a center of Jewish life in Europe, says Kunel. In the past, one had to learn to accept someone who lives next to you and with you, but in a different world. It's necessary today in our heterogeneous immigrant world as well. That's why we celebrate this vanished life, which was a reality here 100 years ago. Lausitz Festival tends to avoid the obvious. For instance, one of Marta Argerich's performances in 2021 was alongside Akane Sakai in the two-piano version of Rite of Spring, accompanying Mikhail Fola in Mussorgsky's Songs and Dances of Death, and in chamber music by the Polish composer Gorazy Nabatowicz. Walking back from such an experience through these extraordinary streets of old-world Europe was simply a joy. In the May 2022 edition of the BBC Music Magazine, we get to interview rising trumpeter star Bradley Wilson. Where were you born? Dartford, UK. What would be your career highlight? Playing in the Chinookie Orchestra for the Louis Vuitton fashion show under Gustavo Dudamel. Playing the music of a black musician, in this case, Tyler, the creator, to celebrate the talents of a black designer, Virgil Abloh. It was a true honor. Who is your musical hero? I really relate to the story of composer Samuel Coleridge Taylor, having struggled to fit within 2 different communities and cultures. What would be your dream concert? Something for classical musical lovers and newbies alike. Perhaps a program made up of Respighi's Pines of Rome, Coleridge Taylor's Ballade in A Minor, and Fatboy Slim's Right Here, Right Now. From the October 2021 edition of Pianist Magazine, Peter Quantrill interviews piano superstar Daniil Trifonov. I will go out on a limb and say that only one pianist ever has given equally accomplished performances of Rachmaninoff, late Bach, and Stockhausen. The pianist I'm talking about is Daniil Trifonov, and 2 summers ago, in July 2019, he was sitting opposite me in a hotel lobby in Verbier. Back then, Trifonov was in the foothills of learning Bach's culminating fugal masterpiece, The Art of Fugue. His intention was to begin performing it the following summer. I like to have a year of little by little getting to know a piece. I like to work on it, then leave it, and maybe come back to it in a month. But we all know what happened next. At the time, all he would say was that his approach to both the cycle and the associated recital tour was at an embryonic stage. The intervening months and years have gestated a remarkable album, The Art of Life, which sets the cycle in the context of music by Bach's prodigally gifted and, of course, rigorously trained family. Notably his sons Carl Philipp Emanuel, most original, Wilhelm Friedemann, his father's favorite, and Johann Christian, most successful as the London Bach. There's generous room, too, though, made for Johann Sebastian's second wife, Anna Magdalena, in the form of excerpts from her 2 notebooks, which form something of a family diary of music-making Chez Bach in the early years of the Kapellmeister's tenure in Leipzig. It's quite something to hear Trifonov whistle through a J.C. Bach presto with his trademark fluidity, a meeting point of technique and imagination for which the only historical parallel that springs to mind is Horowitz's Scarlatti. Before he lavishes those prodigious gifts on a piece as simple as the familiar old Petzold minuet, it's like a Michelin-starred chef taking the time out to prepare you scrambled eggs on toast. When it comes to the Art of Fugue itself and the notoriously unfinished final piece in the cycle, Trifonov's intention back in 2019 was to leave it hanging. I like how Glenn Gould ends. He ends abruptly, and I think that's a strong effect. Second thoughts evidently arose while the world turned still and gave Trifonov the time to reactivate his compositional impulses, holed up at home in Connecticut with his wife Judith. Instead, the pianist's own completion picks up seamlessly from where the master laid down his pen, in the sentimental terminology of CPE's obituary for his father, and proceeds to weave together the composer's BACH signature with the fugue's previously developed themes, as well as the main theme of the entire cycle, before thinning out into a peaceful dissolve. The very brilliance and individuality of Trifonov's solution may well divide opinion, and not for the first time. He spoke to me a couple of days after stunning a packed audience in Verbier with his Decades program, first presented in New York in 2018 and last heard in Berlin in May 2021. A single piece represents each decade of the last century, from the Piano Sonata by Berg, 1909, through to Triste Overheard by Adieu, 1996, taking in idioms as diverse as Klavierstück 9 by Stockhausen, 1955, and China Gates by Adams, 1977, along the way. The idea is so obvious, you wonder why it hasn't been done before. Then you reflect on the flexibility of technique and breadth of artistic sympathies required. The conservative Verbier audience lapped it all up until Trifonov acknowledged the rapturous reception. placed his watch on the music stand, and sat at the piano. Uneasy murmurings gave way to shuffling and then some thin applause, cutting short his spontaneous encore of Cage's 4:33, 1952. It was a showman's gesture, but then Liszt and Charles Rosen in their own times found no contradiction between intellectual brilliance and a virtuoso's flourish. The Decades Project merits a recording no less than Trifonov's award-winning Rachmaninoff cycle to illustrate the continuities as well as the contrasts in modern and modernist piano writing, and to bring pieces like Ligeti's Musica Ricercata to a wider audience beyond the rarefied new music realm. Trifonov places phenomenal demands of concentration and stamina on himself. The Decades recital is presented in 2 70-minute halves. During the past summer, he has played Bach's Chaconne in the left-hand arrangement by Brahms and The Art of Fugue in one unbroken 95-minute span. Such seriousness of purpose is surely a trademark of his Russian schooling, but he doesn't follow the old practice of first studying the score away from the piano. "I've tried doing this before now," he says, "but it has resulted in a calculated approach that didn't feel organic." What he does avoid is other people's recordings, at least early on in the learning process, because they give all kinds of ideas which can be good once you know the piece. "I approach a piece starting to play it to see what I feel about it and what I want to hear. Later on, I will listen to recordings, and I still try to play to my teacher, Sergei Babayan. Then you get all these insights. But in the beginning, you need a personal connection between you and the music. In that sense, playing is an indispensable part of it." Long known first and foremost as a teacher, Babayan now has quite a following as a mercurial performer in his own right, not least thanks to his evolving relationship with Trifonov as teacher, then mentor, and often duet partner. The night after the Decades recital, they played double concertos by Bach and Mozart, and their wordless rapport is plain to hear in the C major Rondo Opus 73 on Trifonov's album of Chopin Evocations. In concert, around the slow movement of the Bach, the two pianists built a pavilion of filigree improvisation, compensating for the long notes of the original solo violin parts that can't be sustained on the piano. "That was spontaneous. We didn't agree on it beforehand. I heard what he does, and I would respond one way or another." Trifonov moved to the U.S. in 2009 to study with Babayan at the suggestion of his previous teacher, Tatiana Zeligman, but the two had barely met before their first lesson at the Cleveland Institute of Music. "I trusted Tatiana. I played the third sonata of Chopin," he continues. "We worked on the first movement. I came in sneakers, and the first thing he made clear was that at the next lesson I would be appearing in more formal clothes." What is Babayan's secret? He is always very detailed and to the point in his comments. He's extremely efficient in the amount he gets done in a certain time. He always has clear ideas. He sees straight to the heart of a problem. It could be a locked shoulder or not enough attention to the pedal or the wrong phrasing. Trifonov goes on to discuss Babayan's connection to the natural forces in a given piece of music, and this concept is one he has developed himself. "It's important to build a connection with the keys. I like to dig into the keyboard with my fingers. so it might look like an octopus trying to devour something. And at this point, Trifonov draws and grasps invisible shapes in the air with his unnervingly long, pale, and, yes, tentacular fingers. Or trying to pull something towards me. Some of this is intuitive. Some of it is practice, and this makes it easier to control the sound. The opening theatrical gesture of Klavierstück 9 is a diminuendo over a pounding chord, repeated first 142, then 87 times. Trifonov appears almost motionless while executing such passages, and I wonder at his finger strength. He gently corrects me. It's in the wrist. The wrist needs to be flexible because if it's tense, it's not healthy for the hands, which get tired quickly. But also the wrist determines the natural kinetic energy of the hand. It's important always to be in motion, never static. Even if my back is arched, because for some music I'll be much closer to the keyboard, I still try to move my spinal cord so it doesn't lock in one position. He points to analogies in nature, such as the movements of a bear or a dolphin, as the model for a kind of second nature when addressing the piano. We often allow ourselves to do very inorganic things. Okay, so the piano isn't the most organic instrument either. Even more, then, we should counteract it with as much fluidity and natural motion as possible. When I was studying in Cleveland, I did some technical studies on how the different touches at the piano produced different waveforms. The tenser the hand was, the sharper the spike on the form, and the faster the decay of the note. What's better is minimizing the entrance attack on the key and then also softening the exit, like catching the key on the way rather than forcing it to go somewhere. Then the sound appears more gradual and lasts longer. The idea of treating the piano as a living organism reminds me of great Russian pianists from the past. And most of all, the well-tempered clavier recorded by Samuel Feinberg. Trifonov nods. Horowitz did this too. In Moscow, we had a 2-year course for the piano students, blind listening to a number of pianists in a given piece. We'd have to react and try to guess who played which version. In a lot of cases, I found Horowitz's version to be my favorite. Reductive talk of a balance between head and heart in performance, whatever the repertoire, quickly seems superficial in the face of Trifonov's analysis. A lot of it is to do with the sending of emotional signals to the tips of the fingers to make the keyboard speak. It's not about a mechanical action, but an organic one. Finding the emotions in the music and amplifying them and making sure they're delivered to the audience. The rest is up to spontaneity. Such responsiveness to the moment comes down to deep listening as much as hours of practice. Sometimes it can be dangerous because I am listening too closely. In one concert, I was playing the Paganini Rhapsody, and I was so intent on the music, I was listening to the opening in the orchestra and waiting for the piano entry, and just for a moment it didn't come to me that I was the one who was actually supposed to play it. In the February 2017 edition of Fanfare Cincinnati, Peter Lackey tells us about the origin of Mozart's Concerto for Two Pianos. Mozart had a sister named Maria Anna, or Nannerl, who was 5 years his senior. Like her brother, Nannerl was a child prodigy on the piano. Their father took them both on extended concert tours to Vienna, Paris, and London, where her success equaled Wolfgang's. It was with her in mind that Mozart composed his Concerto for Two Pianos, but the siblings never performed it together. Instead, Mozart played the work, after his departure from Salzburg, with his talented Viennese student, Josefa Arnhammer, who was madly in love with him, although Mozart did not return her feelings. Actually, in his letters, he called Josefa the Fat Miss, and at one time wrote, "The young lady is a fright, but she plays enchantingly. The only thing she doesn't know is the real subtle singing taste in the cantabile. She tugs at everything." This concerto has always remained popular as one of the jewels of the none-too-large body of works for two pianos and orchestra. It bears some resemblance to another work for two solo instruments and orchestra, written the same year and in the same key, the Sinfonia Concertante for violin and viola. In both works, the two solo parts are strictly equal in terms of their treatment. The words of Hermann Albert from his classic book on Mozart apply to both concertos. Quote, "The two soloists share all their melodies, vary each other's music, interrupt each other, even argue gently on occasion. However, their fraternal agreement is never troubled by any serious differences of opinion." You've been listening to Classical Music Connection, brought to you each week by the Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati, with generous support from Matinee Musicale Cincinnati. I'm your host, David Hatfield, inviting you to join me next week for more fascinating articles on Classical Music Connection.